floods were a significant political as well as environmental issue in early modern England. The environmental consequences of flooding are obvious enough. Large, unexpected, or powerful floods resulted in the loss of human and animal life and widespread damage to property. How this picture of man and nature is political is less immediately obvious. In my paper today, I'll show how flooding was politically problematic on both a local and a national scale throughout the 16th and 17th centuries. I'll argue that statutory innovations in flood management made in the 1530s had ramifications that lasted for well over 150 years. Initially designed to empower local landowners to defend the realm from the enemy of flooding, the Henrician Statute of Sewers created, in the minds of mid-17th century rulers, enemies within, whose defence of the nation against flooding was now significantly holding it back. The conclusions from this paper are drawn from work in progress towards my PhD, which I'll briefly outline now. In my thesis, I focus on how communities coped with and negotiated flooding in the period from the Henrician Statute of Sewers to the early 18th century. Given the relative paucity of studies on early modern flooding and of English environmental history more generally, I've cast my net quite widely and look at flooding from five interconnected angles in five chapters, using case studies of the Vale of Berkeley in Gloucestershire and South Holland in Lincolnshire as examples. The first chapter addresses what floods meant in early modern England. Currently, our understanding of the cultural history of flooding and events that might be termed natural disasters, or generally, is informed by the excellent studies of Providence made by Alexandra Walsham and others. In my first chapter, I offer another view of how floods were understood, one that focuses on narratives produced by those who were flooded, rather than on the printed literature that has been put to so much good use by Walsham. Using parish registers and other esoteric and ephemeral manuscript narrative accounts, I argue that flood victims understood flooding through highly localised cultures of place, kinship and custom, often before they reflected providentially on their experiences. Floods instead had a multitude of meanings which were invoked at different times as communities came to cope with significant material disruption. Having established the importance of local meaning and experience of flooding, chapters 2 and 3 examine the materially profitable and perilous aspects of flooding. Chapter 2 argues that far from being solely malevolent forces, floods were viewed as sources of profit by those who lived with them. Floods and wetland landscapes more generally were put to work by inhabitants. In the course of the 17th century, practical attempts to control flooding through drowned and floated water meadows increased agricultural yields and were symptomatic of a new desire and capacity to engineer the rural landscape. However, floods have never been solely at man's mercy. And in my third chapter, I discuss the impact of damaging flooding. Here I explore the resources that affected communities could draw upon, from relatively informal networks structured around kinship and close proximity, to the more formal political mechanisms available to assist with recovery. Floods were not as absolutely devastating as fires in this period, with no comparable bureaucratic systems of loss recovery and monetary relief. This makes understanding just what damage floods caused somewhat more difficult. This chapter does, however, show how floods had a greater impact on the structurally vulnerable, particularly those reliant on common land, which was often at higher risk of flooding. The final two chapters examine the politics of flooding, which I'll speak about today. Chapter 4 examines the ways in which flood libel and wetland landscapes were represented in disputes over flooding and drainage. It argues that different approaches to flooding stem from different visions of what the nation was and what the nation might become. Floods and wetlands played an underappreciated role in debates over the nation as a productive economic entity, viewed contrastingly as either legally privileged spaces with an ancient legacy or as missed opportunities for development. The final chapter roots these debates in their local social and political context. Focusing on political and legal attempts to manage floodplains. It argues that regardless of the political persuasion of those involved in floodplain management, their interest in and engagement with statutory authorities helped foster the growth of the state. The generous powers given to commissions of sewer and the proliferation of offices for necessarily local individuals played an important and neglected role in the 17th century quickening of the pace of local government. Popular participation in the commissions of sewers and in floodplain management more generally provides a further example of the increasing levels of popular legalism prevalent in England throughout the early modern period. So for the remaining 20 minutes or so, I'd like to pick up on the themes of the final two chapters. The two that attempt to tie to wider contextual issues, flooding that in the first three chapters is painted as a rather local and experiential phenomenon. My central contention is that flooding was as much a political as an environmental problem, and that this was in large part due to the ways in which floods were managed. Alongside this management issue was the way in which floods were represented by different political actors. Attempts to change or preserve the ways in which floods were managed always came with attempts to describe and define land that flooded in ways that made the change or preservation of management seem essential for the safety and wealth of the kingdom. The story of these changing representations tracks other changes in early modern English economic and agricultural history. The languages of depopulation, improvement, and trade are subsequently invoked by all parties attempting to control floodplains. The story of the political administration of these floodplains is anchored more firmly in a single piece of legislation, the 1531 Statute of Sewers, the repercussions of which were felt and negotiated even beyond its repeal in 1930. But before I outline the Statute of Sewers and the impact that I think it had, it's worth considering how floods were managed before it was passed. In the centuries before 1531, flood-liable land was valued much more highly than it would be later in the 17th century. Having been extensively settled by the 11th century, flood-liable coastal marshlands provided vulnerable but highly valued and highly productive agricultural land once it had been inned and embanked. Comparisons with upland agricultural land are striking. In the early 14th century, on the Barnhorn estate of Battle Abbey in Sussex, for example, reclaimed marshland was worth 12 pence an acre, double and in some places quadruple what comparable upland acres were worth. Whilst coastal wetlands were threatened by incursions from the sea throughout the 14th and 15th centuries, communities and landowners overwhelmingly opted to invest in and innovate agricultural practices on marshlands. Seasonally inundated lands sustained a rhythm of hay growing, exceptional summer grazing, and winter fishing and fowling in the most flooded areas. The most heavily flooded landscapes, such as the Lincolnshire Fens, sustained a particularly amphibious economy, with fishermen crossing inundated lands on stilts. As Stephen Rippon has shown, across southern England, wet and flooded land enjoyed a comparatively high economic and cultural value. To cite a local example of this high value, Thomas Elmham praised Henry V for creating marshes at the Pleasance at Kenilworth Castle in his metrical Life of the Monarch. In 1414, Henry changed a dry area overgrown with brambles that harboured suspiciously French foxes to a peaceful marshland, sweetened with running water and made nice. The Statute of Sewers can't be understood without reference to this positive medieval attitude towards wet land, an attitude that differed markedly from that of the later 16th and 17th centuries. The Statute of Sewers referred to drainage ditches, seawalls, and other artificial or managed hydraulic technologies. The origins of the Sewers Act stretch back to 1258, when Henry de Bath was given a commission to settle disputes between the jurors of Romney Marsh and see that flood defence ensured that it was free from some inundation. The commission drew on structures of much older but uncertain origins. In some areas, these pre-statutory flood defence and water management structures were highly developed, particularly within and between intercommoning wetland communities in Lincolnshire. The first Sewers Act was passed in 1427 to formalise the issuing of commissions nationally, offering little administrative innovation and relying on the laws of Romney Marsh that Henry de Bath was originally sent to enforce. Six further time-limited Sewers Acts, designated to accelerate the issuing of commissions of sewers during successive periods of bad flooding, followed in the preceding century, until Thomas Cromwell rewrote the entire Act in 1531. It's a long and significant act, described by Stamford Lemberg as the most important piece of economic legislation of the session. Its principal concern is with flooding, but it also addressed the related issues of drainage and navigation. The Act describes how outrageous flowing surges of the sea and land waters and other outrageous springs, along with mills, dams and other impediments placed in rivers, had caused inestimable damage to the Commonwealth of the realm. Commissioners were to be appointed to oversee the correction, repair and amending of decayed flood defences and nuisance fishing and milling engines. New flood defences might be made from time to time, as the cases necessary shall require. The form of the defence work should be determined by evidence given on the oaths of the honest and lawful men of the shire or place where such defaults or annoyances be. This local opinion would be obtained in the form of local juries of the honest and substantial men of the parishes. The decisions of the commissioners would carry the full effect of law, the statute giving them power to make, constitute and ordain laws, ordinances and decrees. Commissioners had generous summary powers, exercised through a court of sewers. They could fine, imprison, confiscate goods, appoint officials, enforce service, assess and tax the population. To qualify to serve, commissioners were to be barristers, have 40 marks worth of land, or be resident in an incorporated town and own £100 in movable goods. Commissions and the laws they made were to last for 3 years. Amendments under Edward and Elizabeth increased the duration of commissions to 5 and 10 years respectively. The Elizabethan amendment of the Act was significant in that it also made every sewers order perpetually valid. Under the 1531 Act, laws made by the commissioners of sewers were only valid as long as the commission that passed them was enforced, so for 3 years. These could be made permanent only by being enrolled in Chancery and given royal assent. The Elizabethan Amendment removed this requirement and made each sewer's law, verdict and decree a perpetual law, enforceable by each and every subsequent commission, without the need for royal assent. The vast majority of decisions made by the courts of sewers were made with reference to local customary arrangements, and custom was one of the most important sources of authority referenced in sewers decisions. Predicated on practices having existed for time out of mind, systems of local custom structured the lived environment of rural communities and the knowledge systems which governed life. A form of collective memory or memory of the people, custom constructed and reconstructed a usable past for establishing rights and liberty. Documentary recording of custom, as took place in the courts of sewers, fixed in text for posterity what memory had been able to forget and circumstance to forego, in the words of Alan Fox, leaving texts as unflinching reference points against which any future alterations in practice could be measured. Customs presented in courts of sewers were then fixed and made permanent, removing the malleable and negotiative aspects that Andy Wood, amongst others, has done so much to champion. Usable pasts plural became a used past singular, as sewers law rendered ancient practice newly inflexible, and in fixed form a guide to present and future practice. This statute and its Edwardian and Elizabethan amendments made what were ad hoc organisations formed to respond to specific problems or events into semi-permanent ones that governed almost all agricultural and transportation issues in a given waterscape. Commissions were issued to more people more often after the passage of the 1531 Act, and particularly after the Elizabethan Amendment. The extension of a commission's lifetime to 10 years made them, in practice, almost perpetual, as the statute held that, should any commission expire, justices of the peace could assume the roles of commissioners for a year until a new commission was appointed. Elizabeth's extension of the commissions is symptomatic of the increase of government by commission in the 16th century, and particularly of her government's fondness for what Penry Williams calls semi-permanent local commissions, that together provided each shire with a more complex structure of government. The commissions became instruments of government and important local agencies of the state. Commissions invoked national, regional and local levels of political organisation. They were licensed by the Crown and backed by statute, were regional in scope, yet relied on the labour of hundreds of tenants and parishioners. Landowners ran commissions, whilst the middling sort, yeomen farmers, artisans and the wealthier peasants, acted as jurors. Legal power was derived from the highest source in the land, yet devolved to the most local level. Once established, these commissions of sewers came to occupy an important position in the administrative landscapes of flood-prone regions. They grew particularly quickly in response to episodes of damaging flooding. In one of my case study areas, Gloucestershire, the first lasting commission was established in 1583 after the rage of the sea flowing and reflowing had lacerated and broken sea defences. This was the first of many commissions of sewers issued over the course of the later 16th and 17th centuries. Discounting the routinely issued commissions of peace and their adjuncts, commissions of oyer and termina, commissions of sewers made up half of all non-judicial commissions issued for Gloucestershire between 1601 and 1673, and three quarters of all those issued for Lincolnshire. In the period 1601-1673, the Crown and Commonwealth issued at least 547 commissions of sewers. I say at least because the restoration volume of the Commission's entry book in the National Archive contains this rather unfortunate note, along with another just like it, explaining how bundles of warrants for sewers commissions were gnawn in pieces by mice before they could be enrolled. So these rodent infestations aside, commissions of sewers grew in importance in local life. One of the clearest indicators of the growing role of the commissions of sewers in county governance is the increased frequency of court sessions in which flood defence repairs were ordered and negligent parties prosecuted. In Gloucestershire, across the period 1583 to 1631, the Commission's public legal arm, the Court of Sewers, convened 93 times. Initial meetings were stymied by a lack of continuity. With only 16 officials sworn in 1583, the Court was unable to reach quorum, commissioners then being too few in number. This was an issue in 1588, when the Court convened only to find that the majority of the jury were dead. However, devastating flooding in 1607 moved the county to take much more meaningful and concerted action. Widely regarded as the worst single flood in modern British history, the January 1607 flood killed thousands of cattle and farm animals, as well as hundreds of people across southwest England and Wales. From 1583 until the flood of 1607, the court sat 12 times, with no meetings in 17 of these 24 years. In 1607 alone, the court sat 25 times, and a further 6 times in the subsequent 2 years. This spike in the activities of the court is anomalous. In no other year did the court sit more than 6 times. However, this great flurry of activity in 1607 did have a lasting impact. and as this graph shows, commissioned business failed to subside to its pre-flood levels. After the damaging consequences of the 1607 flood and the experience of rectifying some of its negative effects through the court suit, Gloucestershire residents took to codified, legally binding flood defence administration, and thus customary flood defence organisation was definitively altered by statutory authority. The discretionary nature of the legal apparatus enabled the court to be called as and when it was needed. Its fluid arrangements enabled those in danger and in need of swift action to utilise the resources of the state to settle disputes over liability that proved costly if inefficiently dealt with. A similar story can be told for Lincolnshire. Courts of sewers remained relatively infrequent throughout the mid-16th century. In the later 1560s, the east coast of England and the North Sea region more generally experienced increased storminess, culminating in serious marine flooding in late 1570 and 1571. In November 1570, the Netherlands suffered its second worst flood in its history, as the All Saints flood inundated the coast from Groningen to The Hague, and in eastern England, 60 ships were driven aground between Newcastle and the Wash, and the Lincolnshire village of Mumby was reduced to just three houses, with its chapel swept into the sea. Just as in Gloucestershire, meetings of the courts of sewers increased after these disastrous floods, and again failed to return to their low pre-flood frequencies in the aftermath. As this graph of court sessions per year shows, commissioned business grew dramatically and continued at a much increased level after the floods in the early 1570s. In both of these Midland counties, it then appears that having intensively used courts in response to disastrous flooding, neither turned back to previous parochial and manorial arrangements in quite the same way. In Gloucestershire, the devastation of 1607 had effects on the social makeup of the commission. The massive increase in the business of the court brought with it swathes of new jurors and many new commissions. During 1607 alone, 204 new individuals became active within the commission of sewers. This is striking, as until this point, just 125 individuals in total had staffed the court, including those who died in post. Of the 204 new officers, 80% were jurors and 20% were commissioners. The number of men sworn to serve as commissioners more than doubled with the addition of the 1607 appointments. This increase points to a reversal of the contemporary trend of the landed gentry absenting themselves from the business of local government, here seen in a period of crisis. The most dramatic increase came in the number of jurors sworn, with more than triple the number of men entering the commission in the 11 months of 1607 after the flood than were enlisted in the previous 24 years. As the necessity for frequent and urgent court business subsided after 1607, popular involvement with the commission remained strong. In the 24 years after the flood, engagement with the court was much higher than before, with sustained higher levels of recruitment across all offices. Having cemented its position as the primary flood defence agency in the county, the commission remained a participatory and fluid institution, one in which hundreds of local men took their turns to serve. The Statute of Sewers played an important role in the process of state formation, bringing large numbers of people before a statutory authority as officers, jurors or offenders. It codified and fixed customary arrangements and shaped new local legal topographies. It also brought an environmental issue firmly within the purview of the state. Disputes settled between neighbours in remote rural manors were now done so with explicit reference to the prerogative right of the Crown. Whilst power was derived from the Crown, authority remained firmly with those with local expertise. This disjuncture between sources of power and authority could frustrate the Crown in its attempts to change wetland landscapes, and also brought a whole new range of local complaint within its scope. In sum, with its bureaucratisation and standardisation of a traditional form of political organisation, reliance on unpaid officers drawn from the middling sort and above, and its Elizabethan delegation of power to the discretion of the commissioners, the Statute of Sewers was politically a particularly Tudor piece of legislation. With its reverence for marshland and equivocal attitude towards new and improving works, it had at its heart a particularly medieval set of environmental and economic values. Coupled with the proliferation of courts of sewers and the empowerment of local knowledge and landholders, this Tudor statute and its medieval values was on a collision course with emergent desires to drastically alter the floodplains of England. Whilst commissions of sewers were expanding, encompassing a greater number of officers than ever before, and codifying a greater number of customs than they ever had, ideas about flooding in England were changing. In the 1520s, John Fitzherbert had written of the benefits of flooding for the fertility of agricultural land. But by the early 17th century, such ideas had been refined and were expressed as concepts of floating, a technique of managed flooding that induced earlier and stronger growth in meadows. These new waterworks were introduced along with a host of other techniques, including crop rotation cycles that enabled more intensive arable planting and the introduction of new cash crops like coleseed and rapeseed that required drained, irrigated landscapes. New techniques to productively flood land made seasonal riverine and coastal marshes no longer appear to be the bastions of fertility that they once were. The fens and floodplains of England increasingly came to be seen as sites of enormous potential that were currently being squandered. During the later Elizabethan period, fenland and other land that was seasonally inundated came under ever closer scrutiny from agricultural improvers and would-be drainage monopolists. Numerous schemes were put before Elizabeth's Privy Council for the drainage of large parts of eastern England, land that in its present state was also seen as a missed opportunity in terms of both agricultural productivity and crown revenues. The Anglo-Flemish engineer Humphrey Bradley proposed a highly ambitious and optimistic drainage project to rid the fenland of seasonal flooding once and for all. He estimated that it would take just 8,000 men a few months to dig a four-mile channel that would drain 400,000 acres, yielding landowners an extra £40,000 a year in profits. By making this wilderness to a fruitful soil, it would be better able to nourish in good state 100,000 families than the current 1,000 in want. The pro-drainage pamphleteer, known as H.C., lambasted the state of the fens in 1629 as lying promiscuously undrained, and instead he praised the fat and lusty soil of drained fenland and its ability to support a variety of crops, from fruit trees to more traditional grasses and reeds, that would marvellously increase and support the multitude of His Majesty's subjects, wherein consisted the glory and strength of the kingdom. Walter Blythe, in his English Improver Improved, praised the value of managed, moderate flooding, whilst condemning the standing, soaking water, which bred foulness and likewise gnaws at the heart and strength of land, like the worm at the stomach. He criticised Fenlanders and their many unsuccessful drainage schemes as the result of slothful and sleepy slubbering. Such an insistence on the backwardness and laziness of the Fenlanders drew upon a long tradition of derision, stemming from Hippocratic Galenic, who moralised the perceived negative mental and physical effects of living in wet climates. Government policy and early agrarian political economists argued that the fens and floodplains of England were key to national prosperity and success. In 1607, ministers invoked the image of the untapped potential of the nation's floodplains when debating the union with Scotland. New immigrants from Scotland would provide no surcharge of people in this kingdom, as there remained many great wastes, surrounded grounds, and great fishings that could be improved to sustain them. In 1649, the Rump Parliament passed an act for the drainage of the great level of the fens, citing the current situation as yielding but small and uncertain profits. Taming flooding would be to the great advantage and strengthening of the nation, as new coal and rapeseed plants would stimulate soap and oil production to aid the wool trade, hemp and flax could produce linen and cordage for shipping, which in turn would stimulate manufacturers, commerce and trading at home and abroad, all of which would relieve the poor by setting them on work, whilst incredibly leaving land left over for good pasture for cattle and good arable for corn and grain. To this list, Sir William Killigrew managed to add three further reasons why draining would benefit the Commonwealth: for increased taxation revenues on improved ground, by eliminating the City of London's need to spend over £250,000 a year on foreign grain, and by boosting the nation's honour by improving so much useless ground to such great profit. For drainage enthusiasts, there was everything to gain from ridding the nation of uncontrolled flooding. Feckless inhabitants were presented as requiring these changes to sustain life in the fens. They were portrayed as idle and backward. Camden had called the Fenlanders rude, uncivil, and envious to all others. John Norden, an advocate of surveying and improvement, argued, using somewhat mixed metaphors, that the inhabitants of wastes and unimproved land nourished and bred infinite idle fry, that coming ripe grow into vagabonds and infect the Commonwealth with the most dangerous leprosies. Thus, William Dodson's primary reason for his drainage scheme was that Fenlanders, who were formerly very poor, by reason of the uncertainty of their banks, would grow rich and populous to the strengthening of the king and kingdom after their land had been drained. The negative representations of flood-prone regions made by external actors led to conflicts that were frequently realised in the commissions of sewers. Commissioners had to be resident in the area over which they presided, and below them were jurors who had to have knowledge of the land in which they made periodical surveys of. Even if commissioners could be handpicked and influenced by external powers, the weight of numbers of local people on the juries often meant that external designs for commission activity were thwarted. Thus, we can see a clear divide between internal and external forces created by commissioners' need for specialised local expertise. Commissioners were capable of using their privileged position as arbiters of local knowledge to halt unwanted improvement works in the 17th century. In 1619 and 20, Sir Anthony Thomas and his father-in-law Sir William Iloff attempted to drain the Cambridge Fens. Ultimately, they were thwarted by a reluctant and truculent commission of sewers and its political manipulation of local expertise. James I supported their scheme and repeatedly commanded the Cambridgeshire commissioners to assist Thomas and Iloff. Without the commission, no drainage could take place. But Thomas and Iloff and the commissioners were ordered, both Thomas and Iloff and the commissioners were ordered by James to cooperate, and by May 1620, a deal for the Cambridge draining project was made to take place under Thomas and Iloff rather than the commissioners. But in a concession to the local interest, the deal ensured that lands yielding more than 8 shillings a year were exempted, as it was doubted that drainage could provide any profitable improvement on this. Crucially, it was the Commission of Sewers and its jury that was to be the arbiter of this value, as they, rather than Thomas and Iloff, despite their protestations, had the means and local knowledge able to adequately survey the land. Perhaps unpredictably, the Commission returned a majority of the acreage in question as worth more than 8 shillings a year. Iloff and Thomas complained that the land was greatly overestimated and that local jurors were averse to their undertaking and plotting to compel them to desist. Subsequently, the drainage scheme collapsed. By 1630, Charles I had grown increasingly frustrated with Lincolnshire commissions of sewers, finding from them no respect nor conformity to his pleasure. They obstructed drainage enterprises and induced distraction and the overthrow of the business with their partial and unsafe verdicts. Charles threatened to interpose his regal power should they continue to give ear to forward men and create unnecessary difficulties. Here we see the perfect combination of empowered and popular commissions of sewers utilising local knowledge to defend against the schemes of external investors, using the terms of the part Tudor, part medieval statute of sewers. The uncertain legal position of the commissions of sewers regarding the creation of new drainage and flood defence works meant that even when they were pro-drainage, legal opinion could undermine Crown attempts to improve floodplains. The statute's ambivalence towards new works was a legacy of its medieval environmental foundations, and this was not helped when Sir Edward Cook ruled in 1609, in the case of the Isle of Ely, in support of appeals to common law that commissions had no powers to make new works. Direct conflict with the Crown ensued. In November 1616, the Privy Council sought to protect commissions of sewers from prosecution at common law after Fenland commissioners had been prosecuted for ordering drainage works that went beyond the repair of ancient work. Commissioners had landed themselves in trouble with local commoners and landowners for attempting to charge those who enjoyed land would be drained and fine and imprison those who refused to pay. Commoners and local landowners successfully managed to prosecute commissioners for illegally imposing taxes and imprisoning defaulters using Cook's precedent. James's frustrated council saw these fens as ripe for improvement and was dismayed by the success of the prosecution. The council saw the new drainage works as crucial for the preservation of thousands of His Majesty's subjects, their lands, goods and lives, from the fury of the waters. They responded by imprisoning those who had brought the suits against the commissioners and banning them from bringing any more. Beyond these legal challenges that worked both within the commissions of sewers and sought to limit them using other courts, those who sought to disrupt drainage and the alteration of floodplains eventually resorted to rioting and violence against property. In Fenland Riots, the English Revolution, Keith Linley details the multiple campaigns of property violence that followed attempted drainage schemes in the Ancombe level, Deeping Fen and the Bedford level. Ultimately, ideas of a newly improved, dry and flood-free England outstripped the improvers' political and technological capacity to create a universal drained arable landscape. After the failure of major drainage projects in the mid-17th century, drainage schemes came to be derided in the popular press. In 1695, the pseudonymous Person of Honour counted proposed drainage via engines as amongst the private intrigues, secret plots and underhand dealings of the principal projectors of this kingdom. The Fens of England continued to be places of ill health and difference in the popular imagination. In 1697, Celia Fiennes referred to the lazy sort of people that inhabited the wet and marshy Isle of Ely. And in 1724, Daniel Defoe would refer to the Fenland as the great sink of 13 counties, often overflowed. Real progress on drainage and flood control would not be made until the 18th century, when wind and steam power was able to make substantial gains against floodwaters. The story of the commissions of sewers up to the late 17th century is, to an extent, one of old dogs and new tricks. The Statute of Sewers was an inherently conservative piece of legislation designed to preserve a vision of the English landscape that no longer held sway with those with political, legal and economic power in the 17th century. Attempts to use the commissions of sewers to improve floodplains to a level of dryness beyond that seen in the medieval era ran into legal difficulties, followed by formal and informal political protest. It's telling that when the commissions of sewers were cited in the Grand Remonstrant, it was not because they were themselves a problem, but because Charles was seen to have abused them. The strengths of commissions of sewers were that they were to a large extent pluralistic and participative. were their use of and reliance on those who lived and worked on the land. These strengths became weaknesses for the government when this internal perspective did not fit with the external interests' ideas of improvement on floodplains.